When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming, episode 168. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I am not heading far at all. Probably just about 30 miles west, up into the hills to Bala, in my beloved North Wales, to speak to farmer Geraint Davis. Geraint, Samai, how are you?
Well, I'm good, thank you. And yourself?
Yeah, very, very well. Enjoying the spring sunshine. Now, I think you've had rain up there today, haven't you?
Been pretty wintry over last night into this morning. It's beautiful now, but it's promising more on us tonight as well, which is great.
So lots of people listening in the UK might have been to Bala, or at least passed through on the way to Eriri, to Snowdonia, as it's a big tourist area, being such a beautiful part of the world, and with a lake there as well. What's it like to live and farm there, though?
It's a true pleasure, really. We are lucky. Just looking out the window now, we're at the very top of the Dee Valley here, and yeah, it's such a pleasure to be able to call this place home. We take it for granted, and yeah, you can't fault people for wanting to come into this beautiful part of Wales. We are truly blessed here, really.
Okay, and what have you got going on the farm? Obviously sheep being up there.
Well, sheep are a given to be up on the hills here, but yeah, cattle as well. We run about 150 head of cattle. Conservation grazing is a big part of the farm at the moment. And yeah, so juggling sheep, cattle, and the nature side of the farm, all in equal terms, really. That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. So were you born and bred up there?
Yeah, so I've not ventured far from my square mile, really. I grew up across the field, and I'm the third generation to be farming here. And I'm quite lucky, really, because we're tenanted here. And yeah, no, I don't think I've ever wanted to do anything else. So yeah, no, it's a pleasure, really, to be able to call Bedwarian my home.
Yeah, well, you and I are very similar in that regard as well, because I haven't gone very far either. And like me, in school, you couldn't wait to leave. You just couldn't wait to go home to the farm. Is that right?
School and I did not get on at all. I spent more time avoiding classes and trying to be at home, either here, helping my dad and grandfather, or my other grandfather, who was farming in Llanuwchllyn. So, yeah, school, hated it. But now I regret I didn't stick to it to get the grades I wanted, just to say that I've got them. But no. Yeah. I've not a GCSE to my name.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I used to get, well, I just used to spend my time looking out the window, really, in school. And then the teachers would tell you off, and then, yeah, just, yeah. But I also regret it now as well. So, yeah. We're about the same age. I think you were slightly younger than me, but we're very roughly the same age. In 1998, when you were, must have been late teens, you bought a farm. Now, how, yeah. Like, not many people can say that. How did that come about?
Sadly, my grandfather died on the farm he had in Llanuwchllyn, and he had three daughters, and my mum was one of them.
Okay.
And the opportunity came for me to buy my two auntie's shares out of that farm. And, well, I just jumped at the chance. So, yeah, January 1998, I became an owner of a farm. Yeah, big, big pressure on young shoulders, really. I wanted to enjoy myself with my friends, but I had a mortgage to pay, bills to pay. And, you know, it truly changed my life overnight, really. Yeah, no, it's lucky in an unlucky kind of way of losing a grandparent. But, yeah.
I mean, when you're that age, you kind of, I don't know, you think you know it all, but you don't really, do you? But when you look back now, is there anything that you would do differently now you're older and you know a bit more?
Do differently, I would have gone into agri-environmental schemes sooner.
Yeah.
Knowing what they could have generated for the farm in income and capital works for the farm there as well. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of money before I went into any agri-environmental scheme improving the place. And I felt like a right mug when I could have been paid for doing it. But I was young, thought I could achieve everything, conquer everything back then. But
yeah.
There we go. Sorry.
It's all right.
Sorry, Will.
Don't worry.
Sorry, Will.
Is that your BBC career correspondent moment, is it?
It is, yeah. Sorry about that. They've got a knack of doing it every single time. They just want to be seen on camera.
You don't have to explain to me. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, on that then. Yeah. You've got kids. How many kids have you got?
I've got two little girls called Kitty, who's 8, and Betsy, who's 5, going on 18 and 15 in attitude. I'm getting grey hair now, and it's such a delight that I truly enjoy my life with my little girls, and, you know, the proper little farmers, they get mucked in, and, you know, they want to farm. They can't wait for me to pack my bags and head down the drive. And it's so nice to see them engaging in the farm, really.
Yeah. Have you enjoyed having them at home over lockdown?
Yeah, I've got to say, it's been a bit of a juggle. Yeah. But yeah, we've managed. I think homeschooling was outdoors education, really. There wasn't much sitting down and doing schoolwork inside. It was learning about nature and stuff on the farm and things they will never forget. And yeah, just made the most of what we could.
Yeah. I think, yeah, we're so lucky, aren't we, to have been on farms during lockdown. And yeah, for me, I mean, our kids are a similar age to yours, and it just felt like, you know, I was growing up really quickly as well. It felt like, I don't know, bonus time, I guess. You know, it was a challenge homeschooling them and looking after them and juggling it all, but it was, I don't know, it was, I have a feeling we'll look back on this, you know, in future years, with, you know, very fondly, I think.
I think so, yeah. We've been lucky. Where we live, they've been able to go outside and play here. You just feel so sorry for the kids in high-rise flats where they can't get out to play. They've had quite a knock to their development, haven't they, compared to farm children. They've been so, so lucky, I think.
For sure. So what does the farm look like now? You're farming about 1,200 acres, right?
Yeah, so for myself, I started off with the 200 acres in Llanuwchllyn, and 60 acres of that was rented until 2010. Mm-hmm. And how I built it up, obviously, my dad and my grandfather were farming here in Bedwyrion before me. But yeah, there's 1,200 acres now. Around 1,000 acres of that is rough hill ground, and the rest is what I'd like to say productive upland grassland. And yeah. We're quite lucky. We've got what we have, and it kind of lends itself to producing food and caring for the environment quite naturally. We're not pulled in either direction. We just kind of land in the middle there where we can do both. And we're quite lucky, really, in that regard.
Mm. So what about succession? Because you obviously two families involved in the family business originally, and how have you navigated through that minefield?
It's been one hell of a rough ride, to be honest. And as I said, my mum was a partner in the farm that I have in Llanuwchllyn, and I think things were boiling up from the early 2000s. How money was coming in but not paying the bills and everything. They weren't farming a business. They were kind of carefree. And I hate saying this, there was a lot of falling out over this, really. And it was me that was taking the brunt of it all. And myself, at the same time, was seen as the bad guy in all of this with all my other family members. And, yeah, you know, the farm just spiraled into debt. Year on year was going into a deeper, deeper hole. And at the end of the day, I risked losing everything, and they would have been able to just walk away because they were a tenant here and all they'd have to do is sell things. But it was attached to my business as well in a roundabout way, where I'd have lost everything unless things had changed. And we worked hard to try and get it. And I think things really boiled over in a bad way about 2008, 2009, when we got married, really. I didn't want to put Rachel through the kind of strain as well as I was going through with this succession not actually happening. And, you know, when you have debt and how you're trying to manage monthly for your own business and then having to pay your parents' bills as well was not a nice place to be. And I truly just wanted to disappear. But the breakthrough finally came, and my parents moved away in 2010 and we moved in. And we haven't looked back since. That was the make or break moment, and it happened, and I've been so lucky, really, that, you know, it's hard to talk about it without getting very frustrated and angry over it. But, you know, I don't think it's an uncommon problem across farming in the United Kingdom. There's a lot of people in the same position trying to take over, seeing the business going out of control and everything. And, you know, sadly, we've lost a lot of young people through this kind of thing, through suicide and so on. But I'm glad that we were able to weather the storm, and we are here now in a much, much stronger position. And we've rebuilt that relationship with my parents, which is something quite nice to be able to say that we've been able to do, isn't it?
For sure. Yeah, I mean, succession is such a thorny subject, isn't it? I can't quite sort of put my finger on it, really, but whether it's just that farmers, I suppose, we tend to be so busy and we just put our heads down and get on with the day-to-day things and perhaps don't talk about the big stuff and the future, maybe. I don't know. What do you think? Why is it such a difficult subject?
Well, I think there's a degree of that in it, but I think here we were slightly different. It was not managing a business either that was happening. And you know, the times that I sat down with a bank manager trying to get a plan of action for 6 months of getting things on the right track. And there was a lot of, we'll do all this. And within a week or two, you're back to square one where you're seeing random things landing on the yard that shouldn't be part of a farming business being paid for by the business. And just the strain of that as well. But, you know, in a healthy environment where there's a good business being run and people don't want to give up the reins, do they? You go to markets now, you can see three generations walking around together, and it's granddad that holds the checkbook. And it's holding two generations back from going forward. And I hate seeing it.
Okay. So you got that sorted-ish, 2009-10, did you say? And then I guess you thought, okay, that's sorted. Now we can move forward. And then in 2010, testicular cancer. Never rains but it pours.
What had I done to deserve that? I'd felt a lump in my, or a swelling in my testicle for about 6-7 months. Being a typical man, I was not going to go to the doctor. It was fine. I must probably have a knock, I thought.
Yeah, of course.
And I remember the day I went to the doctor, I said, I've got back pain. And because I usually used to go to the doctor with back pain. And they said, my back's playing up again. And I think the doctor got fed up of seeing me with my back. And as I was walking through the door, I built up the courage to say, actually, could you check this out for me? And he said, of course I can. Just lie on the bed. And then he cupped my testicles and, okay, can you be back for a blood test? And I said, shall I just book one? No, I'll get you the blood test book now. Hopefully we'll get it done within half an hour. So basically, I didn't get to go home. I went to the reception, got called back through straight away. The cancer indicators came back within a couple of days. And basically from day of finding that lump with a doctor to having my testicle whipped out was 3 weeks.
Okay, geez.
I've never seen the NHS work so fast, and, you know, truly grateful for how they work. And, you know, it could have spread in that time. You know, they helped an awful lot. And
yeah,
I've been lucky there. In between all that, I had to freeze sperm in Liverpool's women's hospital.
Okay.
And believe me, NHS porn is not that good. So, yeah, you know, you got the stigma of having to go into a room on your own. Well, first off, we turn up to the reception and this beautiful nurse looking at you, knowing exactly what you're there to do, and I'm all embarrassed.
Yeah.
Rachel walking in with me for moral support, and then they give you this form, give you this cup, and off you go. Oh, God, I was embarrassed. But I had to do it 3 times during that 3 weeks so they could have enough samples just in case that I become infertile.
Yeah.
Luckily, fingers crossed, we never had to use it. But yeah, you know, the things that you go through in life, through some mishaps, and
yeah,
I can only laugh back at the experience. You know, if you're to choose a cancer, choose testicular cancer, it's the easiest one for them to cure. And basically, a day before we were due to lamb, I had a heavy dose of chemotherapy and it knocked me back quite a bit. But I had the munchies right through lambing. I'd eat a loaf of bread every day on my own. I just wanted bread. And yeah, it's just bizarre. They said most probably you'll be off your food and you'll have this iron taste in your mouth. And I had this iron taste, but oh, just slice of brown toast with butter on it. I was away, and one piece after the other.
Yeah.
It was, I've had the all clear now. I don't have to go for any checkup or anything. And it was just a blip in my life, I guess. We bounced back from it.
I guess, I don't know. How old were you then? Early 30s?
Yeah, so I was 29, 30, wasn't I?
Yeah, okay. So were you worried you wouldn't be able to have children?
Well, this is the thing. I was a bit worried there. Will I ever have children? And I've always wanted children, even though I'd say, oh, don't want children. It was kind of that mask I put on just to avoid questions sometimes when you're settling down. And it kind of knocked me for quite a while. It was the what if we can't conceive from then onwards. And we were very lucky, really. You know, we're blessed now with 2 little beautiful girls who I can hear behind that door now, which Rachel's trying to take them away. But, every cloud has a silver lining, hasn't it? And they are truly my silver lining.
Yeah, and I'm sure when they came along, because of your experience, it made it doubly special, I guess.
You know, we just wanted a healthy child at the end of the day. But one of the main things we had we have another son, better luck next time. And you're thinking, well, we've got a healthy baby girl here. We have family members saying, oh, you can't produce an heir. Come on. That day and age is so past it, I think. And that hurts even more than, you know, the thought of not having children at one point, where you're measured on your success if you can actually have a boy. I know you've talked about this recently, and what you said, I've had all of this myself, and you know, I get greater pleasure in telling people that how wrong they are to point that out. And silly world, isn't it?
Okay, so you farm, as we mentioned, in a very beautiful part of the world. Is it? It's in National Park, is it?
The land is within the Snowdonia National Park,
Okay, so, and also quite a lot of your land is a site of special scientific interest. Is that a good thing or a bad thing in terms of farming and the way you run your business?
It's both, I think. It's a good thing and a pleasure to be able to farm within an important SSSI.
Yeah.
The national park isn't a problem at all. I think there's a brilliant agricultural team there that works quite well with all the farmers within the park. The planning side of things is another issue for young farmers to be able to stay, or young families to be able to stay in the area. They're quite a pain in that regard in how they go about giving planning permission for people. They'd rather have a holiday let on a farm than a barn conversion for the next generation to farm in or to live in so that they can farm or what have you. But yeah, all this Triple SI land is regulated by Natural Resources Wales, and it's a love-hate relationship that I have there. I want to do so much more, but the Section 16 to restrict me from doing so much more is very prescriptive, and the unwillingness to tweak as we're going along, and it's holding me back from being able to deliver so much more for environmental needs that we have to stand up and do for climate change, nature recovery, and what have you. I've got a long, long list of things I want to do on my farm, but it's the prescriptiveness that's holding us back from going forward here. Really. So a bit of a frustrating time.
Yeah, and you do have, you've got a lot of very special environmental features and a lot of biodiversity there. And one thing I did want to ask you about was the golden plover. Tell us about that.
We are so lucky, really, to have the golden plover up on the hill. Between my mountain and next door, there's a enclosed common next door to us, which has, I think, five graziers on it. Between us, two blocks of ground, there's over a third of the Welsh population nesting with us. And, you know, we're in such a very privileged position to be there. And the prescription to deliver for their success involves livestock production. So you need the animal there to graze for a shorter sward and everything. What some people would view as in sheep wrecked, these birds thrive in it. So it's all about finding that balance, isn't it? And by being there with the sheep that I keep and the cattle that I put up there, the population is growing year on year. And there's nothing. Last year, I calved about 40 cows up on the hill. And going up at first light, say 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning to check on them, the cows were within a couple of hundred metres from one of the nests and the plovers were just going about their business. And yeah, that was one of the most feel-good feelings of farming that I've had in a very long time. It was beautiful, you know. We had a calf that had just been born about 100 metres down to the left-hand side and 100 metres behind me. Yeah, the two plovers getting ready for their breeding season.
Amazing.
Yeah, just something magical about it, really.
What do they look like for people who've never seen them?
They've got a golden colour to their plumage on the back, and then they've got this black feather plume on the breast, really. You know, they're quite a beautiful bird to look at, really, and I would encourage anybody to research them, to know about them, because they're in such a decline in certain parts of the United Kingdom. Yeah, we just need to do more to encourage their habitat so that they can thrive again, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. So you mentioned environmental schemes and that you wished you'd got into them earlier. When did you first start looking at them, and what did the farm look like before you went into them, and sort of what environmental improvements have you seen since you started?
Bedwarian, with no fault to my grandfather or father, they followed a food-producing policy to rip hedges up and produce more food, and you can't blame them one bit for following what government wanted them to do. And, yeah, it was all about getting the most from every inch of this farm to produce food. And, you know, growing up as a child, I feel as if sometimes I had my head in the clouds, walking around, listening to the birds and so on. And I remember in the late 80s, the curlew and the lapwings were starting to go into decline here to the point we lost them. And yeah, basically it was a farm that produced really good stock for a hill farm. And then looking back, gappy hedgerows, lack of shelter, grazing every single corner. I didn't like it. I really didn't like it. And I wasn't able to do anything about that until I was farming on my own accord. And that's what I, 2001, I went into Tir Gofal in Tudy, which is in Llanuwchllyn, the farm that I own. And I remember it was the most, it was like there was a big, big weight lifted off my shoulders. I was going to be paid to do what I wanted to do, which was great. And yeah, the real joy in farming really came from there for me. And always debated with Dad and my granddad. Basically, we are food producers is what I was told, and that's all we should be doing. And to this day, you see that kind of attitude within farming, and I don't like it. We have, by our farming methods, done some damage to the environment, and we are the only ones that can restore that. And how we are to go about it is thinking out the box here. And, you know, we're not going to have to think too far out the box. Little things that we can do on the farm. And kind of Tudy transformed in the first 5 years of Tir Gofal because we had a project officer at the end of the telephone line that we could call and discuss things, and we could tweak things as we went along, and I really enjoyed it. But then I took Fedwarian over, and I basically, again, we had a blank canvas to put into Agrivermental. It was what we wanted to do, myself and Rach. And we designed the scheme. It wasn't perfect, but we got into the scheme. And again, working closely with the Snowdonia National Park, there's a good team there that we were able to throw in funding for hedgerows and so on there. So, yeah, we've basically, over the last 10 odd years, we've created about 14 kilometres of hedgerows on the farm through new established hedgerows, rejuvenating hedgeling, coppicing and so on. And it's transformed the farm. And, you know, you can see in the bird life within the hedgerows, they're there in abundance now. And our management of the hedgerows has changed a lot as well there. And yeah, the farm's developing to what I'm happy to say is my farm. And yeah, enjoying it.
What do you say to farmers who, and you're right, a lot of farmers do sort of think you have to be one or the other. You can be production or you can be environment, but you can't have both. And that is quite a common mindset even now. What do you say to them, and how do we change that?
This is the thing, it's quite hard what we say to them. Some get so offended when you start talking about the environment.
Yes.
I remember going down to Westminster a few years ago. We were supposed to meet with Michael Gove, and we ended up with George Eustace. And I left the meeting the night before, and I was pulled to one side. And you tell that Gove bloke that we are food producers and we should not care about this environment. And I said, oh, hold on, why? Why should I go and say that? Because I think that. Well, I don't think that at all, I said to this farmer. And he was deeply offended. And I said, are you in an agri-environmental scheme? And he went, oh, yeah. Well, what do you think you're doing there by being in one? We do these things. And he really found it hard to admit, because that's part of his income, was being in an agri-environmental scheme. And doesn't matter how you look at it, the more you put into it, the more nature benefits. Even if you're looking at it totally as a business decision to get money out of it, it brings those benefits in a roundabout way that delivers for nature at the same time. I know Glastir is a bit of a touchy scheme that hasn't truly delivered in Wales, because it's RDP money that's open to every other farmer that has a BPS payment coming in. And the way Welsh Government have delivered it has been a little bit unfair for some parts of Wales, and others have benefited quite largely from it. And it's making those farmers not come over to thinking towards the environment at the same time, I think. And I think we're a long, long way away from getting farmers to think in a very positive way towards the environment. I think it's a handful that get it and see its importance. And whilst they're still farming, they're still going to be influencing the next generation as well. Okay. So I think we need to go back to education truly, as in, as soon as you start in ag college or what have you, it should be equal terms through food production and the environment at the same time. And I think it's a miss at the moment.
Yeah, no, I would definitely agree. So how is enhancing nature and biodiversity and the environment on the farm? You know, I know for a fact on your farm that's made you a more profitable and successful business, even the environmental schemes aside. You know, how has that impacted on your bottom line?
In a positive way. The farm, from the food production element of the farm, using them as environmental tools has raised our profitability from livestock production up quite a bit.
Yeah.
When we took over, for the first 2 years, we were pretty much 85% subsidy and then 15% food production. Mm-hmm. But as we were growing in numbers and getting the balance and using them the right way, and again, the environmental tool side of things, the subsidy dependency was coming down and down and down. And I think we are, sadly, it's called a kind of a referendum pivot here. We're 52% subsidy dependent now and 48% food production.
Oh, wow,
so we've really worked hard on getting it to that point. But again, as a business person, if there is a payment for conservation work on this farm, I will seek it and try my best to get hold of it as well. Any business person would be willing to do that. So, you know, we're heading in the right direction. I don't want to be reliant on these payments, but the farm can attract them. That's the thing, really, at the end of the day.
For sure. So what would you like to see from the new environmental schemes that will be coming in Wales?
And enhancing the environment that we actually have the privilege to take care of, I want it to be given us the ability to spend into our rural economy at the same time. Because I had a choice when we took over, do we keep all the aging machinery here and buy them off my parents and so on? Or do we look at it differently? And yeah, the rust buckets that were here, we said, you sell those on and we will invest in what we need on this farm. And we've become big, big users of contractors now. So you've got the guys coming in with the state-of-the-art kits and they are doing a very efficient job for us. They're in and they're out at maybe a higher rate than you'd expect to want to pay. But I'm not paying maybe 5 years for a piece of kit that's worth $100,000, where the contractor can earn so much more by going from farm to farm with it, isn't it? So, yeah. No rusty bits in hedgerows anymore. That's the way. But as I was saying, the important part is to be able to support my rural economy by being able to spend money into it. And that's how we're going to keep Welsh farming going with Welsh people in the countryside. And that links into our language, our heritage and culture at the same time, doesn't it?
Mm, for sure. Now, you mentioned hedges earlier, and you and I have both done a bit with Coed Cadw, the Welsh Woodland Trust, and we were both on a talk they did last year, I think, and you started your talk with my name's Geraint and I'm a hedge addict. Tell us about some of the work you've done with the hedges there and the improvements you've made.
So as I said, we've done over the last 10-12 years about 14 kilometers of hedgerows. And that's a mixture of putting entirely new ones in along the old paths where my dad and granddad ripped them out. And it's just transformed the place. Basically, water running on the ground in the winter, where there's not a hedgerow where they've been ripped out, it continues to go and ends up on the road. Now where the hedgerows are, it stopped the water going all the way through and so on. It's transforming there. But yeah, so I think there's about 1,500 metres in total on this farm that needs rejuvenating, from putting new hedgerows in there, laying strips there as well. And then I think we've finished going around this 200-acre block. I always say to people, you know, the Wallace and Gromit racing through the countryside where they're looking down and you've got hedgerows around every field and stone walls around them. that's how I want my farm to look like from above. And yeah, the benefits the hedgerows bring, isn't it? The first part of the farm to start growing in the spring here is along the hedgerows. So you've got the warmth there. Whether it's harsh winter weather or this hot summer sun, the hedgerow stock are there sheltering and they are benefiting there. And yeah, just our management of them. There's a lot here because we've done a lot of hedge laying recently and so on and planting new. There's not a need for flailing them yet. And just the wildlife within them. You know, a survey was done here a few years ago and the abundance of hedgerow birds that were here was colossal. And it's all down to management of the hedgerow through the year and leaving those berries in there. Because we get to a point here, say, end of November, unless you get sharp frost, you're not going to travel on the ground without making a hell of a mess. So we're restricted from being able to cut the hedgerows then anyway. But as long as they're coming out into the field and hitting the tractor as I go around cutting silage and what have you, why waste money cutting the hedges? Let them grow and manage them by hedge laying and so on. And yeah, it's just something that's been kind of, heartwarming for me as a farmer to see what's benefiting from them. And then the different colours within the bottom of the hedgerow where you've got your weeds growing and right through the season, the different colours of flowers that are coming through. And I, you know, I kind of feel embarrassed being a man or macho man admitting to the lovely colours of flowers that are coming in my hedgerows. And yeah, these things that you take for granted.
Yeah.
You know, my sheep grazed them off before, and now they're there for pollinators and what have you. You're so, so lucky to be able to share it with them now, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I definitely agree. And yeah, just some, I mean, we've done nowhere near as much here as you've done up there, but some of the bits we have done, I've got so much, just so much pleasure out of, and just sort of walking along a new hedge or even a well-established hedge on a sort of summer's evening, seeing all the butterflies and all the nature. I think it's really important for mindfulness and mental health and in farming, which, you know, we have a huge problem with at the end of the day, don't we? So yeah, I think things like that, as you say, it's heartwarming, isn't it?
Yeah, we're so lucky, you know, have a rubbish day and go for a walk on the farm, especially where you've got your hedgerow, especially May coming into bloom, your hawthorn and so on. It's just sheer beauty of something that's part of a landscape. And then the bonus on top of that, whether maybe 5-6 years before that, you put the iron bar in the ground and put that sapling in there, healed it in, and you've seen it develop into a 15, 20-foot tree and is ready for hedgeling, isn't it? And yeah, just seeing the transformation of it is brilliant, isn't it?
Definitely. You've also got some ancient oak woodland on the farm. That's pretty special. Tell us about that.
We're quite lucky. When I was young, I was thinking, oh, these trees, they're in the way. And this was when I was about 10 or 12 because, again, I had the mindset from my dad and my granddad to rip the hedgerows up. I didn't like it. But then I thought, these trees are in the way. We could have some beautiful fields here. And how can we get rid of them? And then I'd had a shitty day, sorry for swearing. And I went for a walk as it was getting dark and I just went through the woods and up to the top. And as I got out to the woods, I turned around and I went back in. And I sat on a rotting oak for about an hour, just gathering my thoughts and just the noise around. And yeah, just again, the beauty of it that just helped me through that rubbish day I'd had. And was able to walk back down to the yard and, yeah, no problem. Let's carry on with what the problem was and sort it out, isn't it? And ever since that, we've got our man-made bug hotels in there and we've got some natural bug hotels in there, which are old beech trees that are dying on their feet and they are just full of life. And, yeah, it's just doesn't matter what hour of the day it is, there's something going on in the woodland, and you could easily lose an hour of the day just listening, not alone watching and seeing.
Yeah.
It's truly brilliant.
Yeah, and those ancient oak woodlands, they're such a special part of our cultural heritage as well, aren't they, and our history. I mean, you know, the cathedrals, aren't they? You know, they're natural cathedrals, and there's a reason why in ancient times in Britain people worshipped in those oak woodlands, isn't there? You know, that you can see why when the sun's rising, and yeah, you get it.
And you know, we've got such a shortage of these ancient woodlands here in Wales. Yeah. We love going to France on holiday, and you go through there and you see the managed woodlands there. Oh, they're so beautiful. But then again, they are managed.
Yeah.
And then you look at some here, you know, oh, it's just the management of them, the tweaking of them. They're in the Glastir scheme at the moment, and I think the Glastir scheme has failed the development of the woodland there. It's kind of standing as a monoculture of well-established oak trees in there, and we're trying to rejuvenate it by interfering and planting the next generation of trees to come in there, really. And unless we act even quicker, we look at losing them because natural regeneration isn't working there, to be honest. And it needs human intervention to have a successful future.
Okay. Wider industry in agriculture, you're involved with lots of different things. You're obviously very busy on the farm and with the family. Why is it important to you to get involved with those different things?
Yeah, if you want to see change, you've got to get out there and be active in doing it. There's no point in being the farmer in markets moaning about everything and expecting somebody else to do it, because most of the time that doesn't, you know, what you want to see does not get done. As great as the farming unions are, they're representing everybody, and there's an awful lot of people that their voices get outvoted in the approach to what you want to see in the future. And yeah, you know, I've just put my head above the parapet in some places and gone for it and say, well, look, I'm not happy with this. I want to see change here. And my biggest frustration was how NRW was managing the land with me. It was supposed to be a working partnership, and it was failing every year. And I said, well, next time the ability to put myself forward, become a board member there comes up, I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky. I became a board member, the first farmer in its existence. And I feel the voice of farming and how farming can care for nature is really being heard there now, because there are great people around the board table and great people within NRW, but we are a good, good talking shop, and the delivery doesn't really get seen on the ground where I'm actually there able to deliver it as well. And it's a long, long journey trying to get things done, because farming is the answer to a lot of problems in this environment of the, you know, the world that we live in. And I want to be part of making that change for good. That sounds kind of cheesy, but
no.
I truly do.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think I'm pretty sure you'd agree with me here that for several years until fairly recently, when I think we've seen some progress, you've seen farmers and environmentalists kind of pistols drawn, like butting heads, arguing. And I found that really frustrating, because I thought, well, ultimately we all want the same thing, but it's all, this is just counterproductive and we're never going to get there. But I think in recent times we've seen a lot more progress, and it's thanks to people like you stepping up and communicating and saying, this is what we can do. If you work with us, we can do so much more. And, you know, I think
we need this partnership to go forward. And, you know, we do mistakes towards caring for the environment as farmers. I do it here. And, you know, how can we all deliver the same thing if we are actually arguing about it, isn't it? And the amount of information and help I've had by engaging in a positive way with the conservationist that I would have locked horns with maybe 10 years ago, at developing my farm in the way I want to see it developed as well. And they're our friends at the end of the day. As you said, we want the same goals achieved, and we can only deliver them together, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, definitely. You also get involved, and community is obviously important to you. You've mentioned it several times through this interview, the local community. You've also got involved with quite a lot of stuff there as well, parish council, former school governor, things like that. That's obviously important to you as well.
Yeah, again, you know, you see these meetings where they're struggling to get people involved and so on. And yeah, I became a parish councillor. My grandfather was doing it before me, and I've always said, well, yeah, if that opportunity comes up, I'll do that. It's for my community. And I did. And from that, I became the representative for the school governors from the parish council. And I really enjoyed it. I was a governor of the school I went to. And, you know, my children are in the same school now. And, you know, the community spirit of it. My fencing contractor, I've gone to primary school, high school, agricultural college, and we're all in the same area. We're still on the same farming estate. And yeah, you know, the friendships for life are developed from school. And we've got to work hard to look after these schools to make sure that they thrive for the next generation to be lucky to go there, really, isn't it?
For sure. So when you're in parish council meetings, are you more of a Jackie Weaver or a Aled's iPad?
We're lucky we don't get that such thing there. We are lucky we've got a great Bethan, who's our clerk, and she's brilliant. I don't think she needs us there as councillors, it all herself. She's such a pro at it.
Yeah, no, you're right though. You know, you need these people who There's people in every sort of rural community who kind of step up and are the beating heartbeat of communities and really drive everything forward on there. And, you know, without those people who are willing to do that, then these communities, you know, they don't exist. So, yeah, really important, I think. I've taken up enough of your time, so we will end this traditional fashion with the 5 hard-hitting questions, if you're ready. What's your all-time favourite song?
I think it's going to have to be Oasis, Don't Look Back in Anger. It's just a song when I was 17, 18 that was out in the charts and has always stuck in my mind. And, you know, Don't Look Back in Anger rings true to what everybody should do, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think that's my favourite song.
Yeah, okay. If you were to write your autobiography, what would the title be?
I guess something like, yeah, How Not to Do It. I wouldn't change, but I wouldn't change a thing.
Yeah. Okay. Do you have a favourite season? I'm quite interested in this because obviously you're so connected with the land and the environment around you. What's your favourite season?
I always have this great feeling when we come into the autumn, the end of the growing season, as the trees are changing colours into their autumnal beauty. And we start to think about next year, especially being sheep farmers farming here, the breeding season. It kind of, the year finishes towards the autumn and starts again at the autumn. And yeah, such a beautiful time of year, I think, especially if you can get an Indian summer going into it as well.
Definitely. Okay, then. If you could know the absolute and total truth to one question, what question would you ask?
I think it would have to be a farming question. And, you know, the future of farming, to those that can make the decisions of what's farming going to be in the future and how it's going to be in the future. I think that's the question I would like the answer for.
Okay, all right then, good one. And then lastly, ending the traditional way, what is your favourite agriculture-related social media account to follow and why?
That's a tough one. I truly love every agriculture-related one, whether it's from an intensive point of view of farming to a nature-friendly type of farming. I can relate to them all and see. And I think any account that gives a positive, what's and all, truthfulness to their life, they're the ones I want to see on social media. Sorry, I haven't got a specific one there.
All right, I'll let you off. Geraint, it's been brilliant to talk to you. I'm so full of admiration for you and everything you're doing up there. And hopefully we can catch up for a beer soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Ral.
And to everyone out there, thanks for listening and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.